You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Executive Director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is the international recording, touring, and guitar virtuoso Aaron Larger Kaplan, back for his third time with more questions. Larger Kaplan was my second guest on All Things Cage on January 9, 2021, and soon after he was asking for an ex post facto quid pro quo, doing another program together, which took place on March 13th, 2021, with our roles reversed. With Larger Kaplan at the helm, our conversation was almost entirely about my 30-plus year journey with John Cage, but I closed the program with a lengthy excerpt by Cage himself from his first public performance of his Overpopulation and Art in 1992. Tonight, Aaron will again ask questions, but we'll also talk about why we listen to music, what we're really asking for from the choices we make, and why musicians tend more often to be what we think of as active listeners. So welcome back to All Things Cage, Aaron. It's been what, a month?
Yes, it's wonderful to be talking with you again, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I don't know who's having who. I think you're having me, but I did want to start us off because I had a very interesting sort of memory flashback, if you will, just this week, which made me think of you. And I know you have your sheet of questions that you want to get to. And I stand ready.
I'm very flexible.
Okay. That's good to hear. Because what I want to talk about with you is something you said, I think it was in our first program. You made a couple of references to the fact that guitar music is the instrument, the guitar is what puts people to sleep or something like that. Do you remember saying that?
Yes, to recall it for the listeners. As a performing artist, I constantly hear from presenters how their guitar is a wonderful instrument, to put people to sleep. And in one particular instance, in variation, probably over a dozen times, a presenter said to me, "I love the guitar. I enjoy the first piece so much. I sleep through the rest of the program and I wake up for the encore. It's just so relaxing." And so I took that as a challenge, and that's how I inspired in part the new lullaby project, because I dare people to fall asleep. It's one string, it's nylon, those strings, and there's no hammers, there's no bow. So I get it. And we're cradling it like a little baby. I mean, in a sense, it is the sexiest of all the instruments. So yeah, there you go.
Okay, well, why this came up, I'm going to give you the really flashback memory, which dates from, I don't know how many years ago, 20 years ago, when I was teaching in Arizona. And I taught a class, technically, I guess it was a music appreciation class. That would be the best way to describe it. And I actually like teaching music appreciation because I do it, I teach by style. So I do like six great dead white composers, all men. So I go from Bach usually to John Cage and talk about style shifts over time. And so, but it is definitely a music appreciation class. And the exercise that I gave this particular class, we're talking about, I don't know, 40 students, 50 students maybe. And I gave them an exercise to do for the entire duration of the course. And I told them that I wanted them to keep a journal that we would use as the subject matter for the last week of the course. So it was a requirement. I needed them to do this. And the journal was to, on however frequently they felt it appropriate to do, but maybe reasonable would say that they would do this at least weekly, is I wanted them to tell me in their journal all of the instances, each instance where music was in their presence and how it got there. So I wanted to know whether or not they initiated the music or whether it was public music, whether or not it was a concert that they were dragged to, however they were in the presence of this music. And if they had control over what they were listening to, I wanted to know what triggered the listening. That is to say, why did they put music on? So I really wanted them to get clear about what music was in their life. And they did that. And it was rather the result of this exercise was extraordinary to me. because out of these 40, 50 students in their journals, there was not one student who said, I put a piece of music on because I wanted to hear it.
Oh, really?
Isn't that
not one?
I know, not one, not one.
But can you give us a context years? Is this the early thousands?
This was, no, this
2010?
Early
90s?
90s, yeah.
90s. Early 90s. Okay, no Spotify, still on CDs and a few cassettes.
And radio.
And radio.
Yes, okay. And live concerts. This was right. A college campus, so there were things going on. So I wasn't so much interested in the public music, although that was interesting in and of itself. But it was just really interesting to me that not one student talked about initiating music without it having a purpose. For example, they would play music before they went to bed to help them sleep. They would play music before a date to get jazzed up. They were partying with friends and wanted some dance music. It all had a functionality in their lives. Every time they had control over it, they had less to say about public music. You know, I would say someone might comment that they were in an elevator and the music was, you know, some sort of Muzak-like cover of some song or something like that, that they didn't really notice until this exercise came up, or a concert that they were taken to. But it was really this whole question about why do people listen to music? And it's really bare bones positioning. These kids, mm-hmm. when they made a decision to listen to music, it seemed always tied to some mood elevation, or they were trying to alter their personalities in some sense, or alter their behavior, or alter their energy. Mm-hmm. I was less interested in what they were listening to than why they were listening to it, I guess is fair to say. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't thought of this in a long time, but I remember at the time being very struck by the functionality of music. As a music student, I'm sure you'll agree with this, and ongoingly, and perhaps even before you went to school, music for you was a thing that you paid attention to, like conversation. Like it was something you were listening to and learning from and curious about. So you would listen to music. I would never, for example, listen to music while I'm having a dinner party. I just would never do such a thing because it's like another voice in the room. And it irritates me if I'm sharing something with you and someone else is in the room and starts talking while we're listening as if that's okay. You know, right. that isn't a conversation that you yourself are engaging in with this piece of music. And I just found it fascinating that this, out of this entire research pool, if you will, that there wasn't one person who came to me and said, this is a really stupid exercise. I put on music because I want to listen to that particular song, or it was always about what that song or that piece, whatever it was, would do for them, how it would alter things for them. Hmm. Okay, so fast forward to this past week, which is what made me write to you. And say, okay. Can we do one little sidebar here? Is that it was on an NPR station. I was driving, and it was an interview with a musician. He's a guitarist and a songwriter and a singer named David Berkley. And I'm not divulging anything. This was an open air interview. So, and he shared the fact that in his concert life, he was approached by a fellow who told him that his wife and he became engaged at the close of one of his concerts, and how meaningful that was to him. And there he was that night at this concert of this fellow. And David Berkley was pleased and said, that's great. You know, and he said, well, not really, because we're just kind of on skids and it's looking like we're going to break up. And I'm wondering you, David Berkley, whether or not you could be hired to come and give us a private concert and perform for us in my apartment. I'm going to cook her dinner. And David thought, well, okay, you know, why not? Sure. So he did. And what struck me most about what he was saying was that he spent the evening, a couple of hours, serenading them with love songs, playing mm-hmm. the guitar and singing. And he was maybe 3 or 4 feet away from them because they were sitting on a couch and they were making out the entire time. And he said that every now and then he would try not to look at them, but then when he looked over, one of them was moving in for a big kiss and their eyes would meet. which he said it was very, very uncomfortable. The whole thing was really uncomfortable. But it was, you know, he was playing the mood music for this couple who were trying to rejoin. So fast forward for him in the interview, a couple years later, he's giving a concert, and who should come in backstage is the same guy, but this time he's with a friend, a buddy. And he says, "Do you remember me?" And David said, "How could I forget?" It's indelible. And he said, "How did it work out?" And he said, "Oh, it didn't. We broke up." But he said, "You know, I've got this other woman in my eye. And I'm wondering, you know, are you still available? Would you?" So,
hazard pay. I want hazard pay.
Exactly. Exactly. So it was a very funny interview. And he was very funny. And he was just saying that he didn't know how he personally felt about being this kind of musical wingman.
Okay, let's look at musical examples of this, because this exists. One of the most famous keyboard pieces of all time is the Goldberg Variations, written as a means to help the Bach's, the commissioned from Bach, to help patron Goldberg fall asleep. Personally, if someone said, "Come play lullabies at my bedside," it would have to be very beneficial for me. And I can understand why you would want a bed with curtains around it. So I feel I didn't hear this story about David Berkeley. I don't know. I mean, because I played weddings through college. It's one of the ways I got through college and after college until I got my feet on the ground. And I still play the occasional wedding, which is very much music for an event. I mean, I am not on stage. It's not meant as a thing for people to clap for. And it's not about me. And I have loved that experience. I mean, the pressure, I play for the ceremony, and having to cut a piece or time a piece to fit just right. And knowing that the music is being used for what I hope is a greater good and a memory. And sadly, talking to bride and grooms later after the fact, very few of them remember what I actually played or heard me. But I think music as a function, I think your first story about teaching students and how they didn't turn on a piece of music to hear that piece of music, for me, I start to understand a bit about myself, why I don't enjoy going to parties per se, why I enjoy putting the radio on to hear what might be played. That's why I like the radio, if I listen to the radio. Every other time I put on music, and it's not all the time, it's actually very rare during the day, I consider music an active endeavor. I am listening to it. I want to hear what's happening. Does it transform me? Concerts change my mood. I can put on music while I make coffee and it'll change my mood or a compliment, but I feel it's very active. And maybe I'm just a control freak. And that's just when you choose what you're listening to, do you go, "I want to hear this piece," or do you hit random? "I don't know what's going to play today. Oh, I haven't listened to this album." I did a very scientific poll on Facebook, sarcasm. And I asked my friends, I would say, you know, the people who saw it, 80% are musicians or some contact with music. And I asked, "Do you go to concerts because of the program or because who's performing? What about you?" Let me ask you before I tell you the results. What about you? Do you go to a concert based on the program or the performer?
It varies. And sometimes it's one and sometimes it's the other. You give a concert and I can come, I would come for you because I'm interested. So no, but it's true. I'm interested in what you're interested in. So I want to hear what it is that you've chosen to play. But sometimes, you know, I remember the first time I ever saw Peter Grimes. I had those little tickets in my hand, you know, for weeks. I was so excited about that. I didn't care who was performing it. It was a good performance, of course. But, you know, it was like I had never seen Peter Grimes and I wanted to hear it live.
That's where I think I fall, but it was overwhelming. 80% said they chose based on who's performing. And I was like, well, how do you find new music? How do you discover someone that you've never heard of. And quite a few were people, and these are professional musicians, that they didn't want to take that risk per se. You know, that's not what mattered. They'd rather go see great artists, of course, which just shocked me, because if it's a great program, I'm like, wow, that's a great program. Someone must have real energy to put on that program. I want to see who this person is.
But the whole thing that what you were saying about active listening, you said that much clearer and more succinctly than I was putting it. It's what sets musicians, I think, apart from non-musicians, is that that is an active process.
I think it's also very much cultural. And this is even pre-internet, where music is on all the time, everywhere. If we look at North Indian classical music, Ravi Shankar, Ali Akbar Khan, they have an aesthetic. It's called Rasa, R-A-S-A, where the performer in the audience, when they are both aligned, when the performer is on fire and the audience is following with it, picking up, the two of them create a sense of nirvana and can reach this state. And now, the tradition, though, it's a completely different tradition. It's a groove-based music, meaning the music is in cycles. The audience can count along. And if you've ever gone to a North Indian classical concert, sit up high so you can see the audience on the front counting together. I mean, it's amazing. Flamenco has a similar aspect to it, where the cycles of rhythms, you have audience members doing the compás, and audience members saying ole and at the end of the phrase. The closest thing I ever experienced to that was performing in Italy and hearing people at the end of a phrase say bravo. I mean, unbelievably, I felt like I was 30 feet tall. Like, watch this, watch what I'm going to do now. And I think culturally, the idea of active listening in the US is, I mean, come on, people watch Netflix on their television while having a laptop on their lap and their phone next to them. Squirrel listening, you know, where our heads are in 50 different places. And I'm guilty of that as well. I'm not saying I'm above that fray. So you got me very inspired. You make me want to ask my students to journal and ask them this question.
I think it was really, really instructive for them. And it wasn't judging them at the time. It's just reflecting upon it now, how extraordinary that was for me to realize that this body of people had never thought about music as something that they could partake of in the way that, say, I did, that it was somehow a learned thing. And I don't know that that's true. I can say, in all honesty, I can't remember a time in my life when I enjoyed a party where there's music. I don't enjoy it.
What about dancing?
Dancing's different. Okay. So dancing's different.
I have a hard time restaurants with music. I can't eat with music usually. I mean, there are times I'll put on stuff just low enough that it's there, or else I have to have it really loud and I just don't talk and I just listen. But when I drive, I love music to a certain point and then I'd rather have talk. The other day I had to take a drive and I put the All Things Cage on my phone. I was like, this is awesome. So I think it's kind of like cooking. I have friends who eat out every day. The idea of cooking, it's magic. They have no idea how it's done and they don't really question. They like going and having someone else present something to them. They don't care about how it's made up. Does it taste good? I guess some people are like that with music. I think a lot of people are like that.
Yeah. Again, it's not a judgment call at all. It's more just a kind of phenomenological thing. And what struck me as so funny about David Berkeley, about this story, was thinking about you and the guitar. And I literally missed the first half of the program, so I didn't even know what instrument he played. I didn't know. And so when it ended, I called Ralph, my partner, and I said, look this guy up for me, please, because I was still driving. I said, who is David Berkeley? And he said, oh, he's a singer-songwriter and a guitarist. I said, I knew it. I knew it. He's a guitarist. What kind of guitar? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, just read. What does it say, you know, in Wikipedia? It turned out he plays a Spanish guitar.
He does play Spanish.
Yes, which he bought in New York City, like, you know, down on Canal Street, for just a used Spanish guitar. Yeah. It struck me as so funny because remembering you saying about guitar music putting you to sleep. And in this case, it had the opposite effect.
Yes.
However, he was singing.
Yeah, and that's completely different,
doesn't it? You know?
Yeah. I think textures and timbres, my experience, music school, I went to New England Conservatory. I had the solfege, ear training, and the likes. And I find Western music schools teach a priority of pitch, rhythm, timbre in that order. And that's not how I hear. I just don't. I'm pretty much timbre, rhythm at the top, and then pitch probably three or four spots down.
Interesting. So that explains a bit why you know a bit about Indian music. Do you like Balinese music?
Indonesian music?
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
And there's certain, it's like the prepared piano pieces of Cage. They make complete sense to me. I mean, as much as they can make sense. I was listening to a wonderful album by a new album by a composer, Curtis Hughes. This is on a new Focus Recordings, just came out. And I know Curtis, he had written a piece for me. And I was listening to it, and it's percussion opens. First two pieces is a solo snare drum, and then there's a percussion quartet. And I've never considered myself a big percussion ensemble person. It's just, it's cool, but you know, I like it in concert, not a CD thing or an album thing. And it blew my mind, just blew my mind. Great piece of work. And then I'm listening to the album, there's chamber music, and it got to a piece that I think it was piano and bass clarinet or something. And the piano just sounded completely flat to me. And I know the pianist, wonderful pianist. And other recordings, it's not the recording quality. It's that all of these colors that exist in the musical ensemble that I heard, and I go to a piano, and the piano doesn't have, I mean, color. I mean, pianists, I know you guys all want to tell me, yes, there is color on the piano, and you have pedals that can adjust that. Yes, but not quite like the way I'm talking about. The sul ponticello, the pizzicato, the percussive tambura. I mean, there's the vibrato, all of these elements that exist in music, and it makes, for me, music to be three-dimensional. There are piano pieces, of course, that demonstrate this. I'm not trying to be hard on piano. I don't use a hammer to play, though. I use my fingers. And so I think how we listen, this isn't taught. We don't discuss this. This is my just self-discovery is by just listening and going to concerts and asking myself, what did I like and not like? Not with judgment, but what goes on. And many of my friends with perfect pitch, they don't hear timbre. They hear the guitar, and I play my four different middle Cs, and they're a bit confused. Well, they're not all the same pitch. I'm like, well, that's not what we're talking about. They're very close. But what quality changes? And I think that element is, this is why I know Cage would like guitar, because the man understood color and he understood the beating of the sound waves and the different qualities that aren't encapsulated on a piece of paper that has black dots on it. How do you notate that? How do you notate the pulsing of it or the vibrato? We say play with vibrato. What does that mean? There's a multitude of types of vibrato. And it's stylistic. Well, this is what my teacher told me to do, or this is what so-and-so's recording. There is so much depth to what we do.
I know.
It gives me the shivers.
Just I know. It's so interesting. Another thing that I think is really important, what you were just talking about the piano, is that I always feel, remember what I was telling you why I took up the guitar? Because there was some physicality that was lacking for me in my piano studies. But I find the same thing in performance, the piano. So I go to piano concerts all the time, of course, right. But there's no real physicality going on. Someone is stationary. They're really very much in place. Activity is from the shoulder down pretty much. There's no real physicality to piano performance where there is with percussion in spades.
Right. Or you watch a cellist and it's just like they're grinding out these notes. Or yeah. I had a conversation with a student of mine about this, a singer. It's the first instrument. And it is so unique. There, two singers can sing the same thing, the same accents, and it's completely different.
That's true.
Yeah. So It's so you get me now. My mind is all going everywhere about everything, and now I have to get back. Can I get back on, ask you some more
Yes,
questions?
of course, of course. I'm quite sure this is going to bleed into our answers, though.
Yes, I do. Well, okay, so oh, you're I have John Cage trust questions, but I want to wait a little bit. There's a question that I really wanted to get to in the last time we spoke, and we didn't. John Cage is, of course, known for Chance, and how he created it and brought it into his music, and this huge door that it opened and into his composition. But at the same time, we in the 40s and 50s, so I think he started Chance, was it 51 or 50? Yeah, 51.
Music of
Okay.
Changes, we tend to think of Music of Changes as the work, creeping in before that. But yeah.
Okay. At that same time, the popular music of the age is jazz. And its basis is improvisation. And so I don't, this might be a very quick answer, but did John, Mr. Cage, ever say anything about improvisation? And he doesn't really write anything that I've seen that asks for improvisation as opposed to chance. They're different.
It's not a short answer, Aaron. We could do a whole program on this very question, honestly, with John Cage, because 10 years ago, and for many, many musicians to this day, I would have said that Cage didn't like jazz. He just didn't like, he didn't have a feeling for jazz, you know. But that's not true. What he didn't have a feeling for was repetition. He didn't have a feeling for the falling back on learned things, which oftentimes improvisation can bring out in a person. Not always, but you know, I mean, free jazz certainly doesn't do that much. And I just recently learned that Ornette Coleman was a big fan of John Cage, which I find fascinating.
Who I think I know one of your listeners will correct me. I think Ornette Coleman is the godfather of Lars Ulrich, the drummer for Metallica.
Really? That
Yeah,
could be. That could be.
I'm pretty sure because Lars's father was a huge jazz fan and Ornette Coleman was coming over and all these jazz artists were coming to the Europe post war World War II and on all and his father Lars's father apparently would put people up and so Ornette was Lars's godfather which just kind of blows my mind
That's
but
so funny. He was apparently a much more interesting fellow than I ever gave him credit for, Ornette Coleman. I don't know why that is exactly, but going back to your question, Cage wrote a number of pieces that are called composed improvisation. And what he was trying to do with these pieces is make it impossible for the player to rely upon habit or patterns that are well established in the hands or in the mind. Here's a very clear-cut example. All of the pieces that were written for plant materials, okay, so Child of Tree, all of these pieces are to be played on instruments that cannot be repeated. So you're playing amplified cacti, which by the end of your performance will have crumbled to nothing, you know, or plant materials of pod rattles, you know, which break down. So you can't master a pod rattle. There's no such thing as mastering a pod rattle. Different than a guitar. You can master that guitar of it.
It's a pattern-based instrument,
Of
and
course,
I
as is the piano, big time. You know, the piano is like you want to, you know, anybody ask why a student studies and practices Czerny scales, you know, 6 hours a day. It's to get that memory into the fingers. So you don't even have to think about it. When you see something go from here to there, big gesture I just made, the hands know how to do that. They just know how to do that. But that is not the case with plant matter, which is deteriorating as you use it. So that was one strategy of Cage to create compositions wherein you're called upon to use instruments that cannot be repeated. That you can't get them again. Another one that he did, I'm blocking the name of it, which is really silly. I'll try to pop it in if it comes back to me. But the first time Cage himself performed it was on a Cracker Jack box. Oh, it was called Sound Anonymously Received. And this piece, the basic premise of this piece is that you are a performer and you're going to go on and somebody gives you an instrument, not your own, before you go on the stage and you have to perform using this instrument. And the first time it was ever performed was by John Cage, and somebody gave him an empty Cracker Jack box. Lovely, huh? No possibility of mastering your Cracker Jack box, right. You know, because he didn't even know what he was going to receive.
Now that is Friday night game night. Like that is cool. Well, I know he has a piano piece, Jazz Study. It's yes. Early 40s. He has another piano piece, Ad Lib. So there, I didn't ever think that he didn't like jazz. I just had no idea what he listened to.
He just didn't like the practice of jazz. It was antithetical to the way that he thought about music.
Well, I remember an instructor at the conservatory, you know, you practice your 2-6-5-1 cadence in every key in various voicings, and you go through and that's what you practice. And it was like, even for me, I had played a little jazz in high school, but had gone classical, but I wanted to touch up. I tried that for a couple of days and I couldn't do it. Just, that's not how I function. I get bored way too easily.
We talked about that. We talked about that in the sense that people who are not really knowledgeable about music think that it's your skills are transferable, that you can play flamenco, you can play jazz, you can play pop, you can play classical. And really the training for each of those things is very different one from the other.
I constantly, after a concert, when I used to play concerts in public, I would have someone come up to me and say, I play guitar, but not like you. Oh my God. And I, straight out of every time, well, can you sing and play? Well, of course. And I can sing two songs and play guitar. One is Mercedes-Benz, Janis Joplin, Oh uh-huh. Lord, because uh-huh. there's no guitar part. And two is Wild Thing, because it's voice, then guitar. Uh-huh. And I tried doing the band thing and I could do it, but I couldn't play rhythm guitar. I'm supposed to play the same four chords 15 times. No. And it's a different skill. And I've taught students who can go on tour on a week's notice and learn 45 songs. And I ask, how do you do that? And they go, well, it's all in the same key and you just learn the cutoffs. And I space out. It's not how I'm wired. So I have ample respect for anyone who can sing and play, and people who play rhythm guitar. It's like a marathoner versus a sprinter. I mean, they're just different beings. So I'm okay with that.
So do you think that in going back to poor little Michael Berkeley right now, keep picking on
who doesn't know we're talking about him. I really hope he hears this.
I hope so too, because I really enjoyed hearing him. So do you think that, I didn't even know what I wanted to ask. Going back to your comment about the guitar being sleepy music, you know, that it helps soothe the savage beast, which I like. I don't think this is not a disdainful thing to say about the instrument. But the minute I found out that he was also a singer, that was not apparent, you know, mm-hmm. when he was talking, I didn't know that he was also singing songs to them, which made it even funnier in a way.
Well, the whole tradition of lute songs, you know, John Dowland and Byrd and these guys in their century, they were the pro basketball players. I mean, worth millions at that time, you know, and they would, different courts would court them. I mean, they were telling stories of love, and these are the bards. And I think that image, that's fine with me. I have no problem with that. If I help someone relax and they doze off, you know what? Cool. We live in a stressful society. You know, there's a lot going on. There's a piece that I play called Tracing a Wheel on Water. It's by Kevin Siegfried. And he's a composer who's up in Northern Massachusetts in Andover area, teaches at Boston Conservatory. Wonderful, wonderful composer. And you would call it minimalist, but he hates that title. And I just, there's a lot of repetition, but it's not always the same. And this piece He was living in Maine at the time on an ocean inlet, and he was watching the water go in and out, and he was affected by it. His whole family was affected by the tides. And so he wanted to do a meditation on the stasis and movement. It's for the listener. And if someone feels relaxed by something, that's wonderful. And if someone feels energized by something, that's great. Beethoven's 9 has been misused by so many different countries and peoples that what is it? And I'm okay with that. I went on a date, on a first date in high school, and I played Gloria with the Doors singing it. I didn't know what the words meant. Well, it's one of those things I look back and I go, I can't believe she went on a second date with me.
Well,
so,
you know, and Michael Berkeley, in his defense, you know, admitted that he had used his own songs to court women many times, you know, that he was not above that. It was just the circumstances, the intimacy, I guess, at such close range that was troubling.
When I taught one of my first teaching jobs was at a private school north of Boston, middle school kids who had to learn guitar, a group of guitar class. And first day of class, do you get girls by playing guitar? And my response, and I was very happy with this response and I use it still, by the time you're good enough to get girls with your guitar, you'll know better than to do that. Look, we play music and I know it's a trade, but it's also magic. I mean, we take these dots on a page or instructions and we go, these are how these notes move together and they vibrate and they move us in such a manner. I think that composers, performers, we're so into the act of what we do and making a living, and that we forget that before recorded music, it was just magic. That's all we were. I mean, there were no recorded sounds. When you would sing to your child, just because that's the only way. And every culture has some sort of lullaby. Cultures that ban music, they still have it. And I love listening to foreign films because of the same issue. I listen to, not overdubbed, I listen to the original. I have no idea what's being said often, but I love hearing the rhythm of people's voices and saying what goes on. I had a question on this area because John Cage loved literature. He loved the spoken word. His lectures, especially the recordings, are fantastic. And he wrote some songs, but not lots of songs. I'm wondering, was there a reason he didn't write more songs?
I have no idea.
I found a couple of albums and I'm like, wow, I rarely hear songs of Cage. I mean, there's the Widow of 18 Springs comes to mind, of course.
The Wonderful Widow,
which is amazing. I've actually done that with a wonderful baritone. We did it with the guitar turned upside down and, you know, fantastic piece. But other than there's tons of pieces that ask for reciting poetry or literature, but there aren't many songs. And so I didn't know if you had any insight into that.
No, not at all. But you know, that reminded me of, well, two things. One, you were talking about, you know, the voice being the only instrument, so to speak.
First instrument.
But there's that wonderful line in just 45 minutes for a speaker, where he says, get rid of all of the records in Texas and somebody will learn to sing.
I don't remember that one, but throw away all the records in Texas.
In Texas and somebody will learn to sing.
Someone will learn to sing.
Yeah. And so part of it is necessity is a mother of invention, that if you don't have records, what would you do? Would all of a sudden our culture, if we didn't have radio, if we didn't have all these means of bringing other people's music in, would we make it ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
And the piano, you know, the piano was the parlor instrument for well over a century.
Oh yeah. It took over the lute. It was the lute.
Exactly.
And then keyboard took over.
Exactly. It just became the instrument. Every learned person learned to play the piano.
Yeah.
Do you know the Ars Nova Choral Works recording, the CD that they did? I think they're out of the Netherlands.
It was the first CD I ever received on which there was a recording of one of the number pieces, which I think was 4-2. one of those late number pieces. It was the first CD I'd ever gotten where the ensemble chose to do it twice. So it took two tracks.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. To show that it's impossible to repeat a number piece exactly. You just can't. But it is recognizable. You know, it's harmonic color. It keeps its timbral sensibility about it. But it's definitely a different version, if you will.
Yeah, so the Choral Works one.
Yes.
Yeah,
that... Oh, my God. So beautiful. I played that CD right after I got it. I played it for Jasper Johns, who had come mm-hmm. to dinner. And I said, isn't that just so beautiful? And he said, maybe too beautiful.
May we all be so lucky.
Yes. Oh. It's like, oh, bring it on, bring it on.
I like that. Anyway. Can you tell me, you're the John Cage Professor of Performance Art at Bard College.
That's where correct.
The trust calls home. What does that entail?
It is a professorial position that came with our coming into residency at Bard. And because I had already been running the trust for the many years that I had, I balked because I said, I do not have time to teach and run the John Cage Trust. I can't possibly do that.
Right.
And it was worked out very simply that I would teach at will. So when I felt like doing something, they would make room for me to do it. So I don't teach regularly. I just never mm-hmm. have the time to. And now we have no students. So it's not entirely right. good, but they're beginning to come back. And I always will teach for other people. So if somebody, if they're doing, you know, whatever, a modern dance class, and they want to talk about Cage Cunningham or something, right. you know, I'll go and give a very learned lecture about that stuff. But the question is interesting, Aaron, because there is no Department of Performance Art at Bard.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we did that on purpose because there is the danger when you bring somebody like John Cage into a university setting such as Bard, which is so liberal art, it is so varied in its programs, that you become pegged to one of those programs. You become mm-hmm. Tied to the conservatory, or you get tied. Right. More often, it'll be more to writing. It'll be a theater program, maybe. So we did that on purpose to keep the activities of the John Cage Trust fluid across the campus. So as applicable to the conservatory as it is to the poetry program, mm-hmm. as it is to the dance program. Okay. So we did that on purpose.
Yeah, and I know you've done some amazing work there. I mean, you've put on various large-scale pieces. What I was reading, you did the Satie, and you did the lecture on weather. There's some cool things that's going on. So.
Yes, the last thing that we did was in the fall prior to the pandemic, which was the fall of 19, where mm-hmm. we did one of my favorite things that we ever did here was in the Spiegel Tent, which is an outdoor, it's like a circus tent, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's hard bodied, so it's not really a tent, but it's very circus-like inside. And we did a music and dance circus, which was the first time I had ever done one where we invited dance. And we put the dancers in the center of the space and all the musicians were around the dancers. It was too fun. Wonderful, wonderful thing.
So the Cage Trust started after he passed. Where do you see the trust in 10, 20 years? I mean, where's the growth? Is it just keep being there for people?
I had this very conversation with someone right before we got on the air. Right before we started this program. It's so funny. You know, the Cage Trust took shape when Cage died. It left a lot of people in the lurch. Mm-hmm. So it became an organization which was highly responsive to the demands of the world. We were really there to help people finish projects. But of course, every finished project led to another start of a project.
Right.
And then in fairly short order, I want to say in about 3, maybe 4 years, I became more interested in producing. I wanted to direct. I wanted to create things, not just help other people create things. Right. And so I started doing programs. I started to create programs. The first one was the touring show of Alphabet, where I took Cage's radio play and took it on the road and cast it with local people and and people from home, and we all traveled for 2 years together. It was fabulous. It was really great. That was really the first big undertaking. But in answer to your question, more importantly, where does it go? It goes where whoever's taking care of things wants it to go. As long as they have the energy and they have the passion and they have knowledge. The challenge as the trust goes forward is going to be that there will not be someone at the helm who knew John Cage. Right. And I'm very, very aware that I inherited a kind of authority in that, you know, that when I started the John Cage Trust, there was an immediate acceptance of me in that position. And the longer we go on, there are fewer and fewer people who, you know, someday I will disappear. I was talking to someone about that, you know, where do you find a person who wants to do that, who wants right. to take on something with a big built-in barrier about it. But then he reminded me in this conversation, as time goes on, there will be less and less people who knew John Cage as well.
Right.
You know, it'll be an even playing field. It will be like Beethoven, you know, right. it will be like someone who gives workshops on Satie. I mean, that was a different, you know.
It'll become a scholar. This is what I have found. This is what Laura Kuhn said. This is the first time in 1998 she said this. And
but Aaron, you know, I've said it before and I'm going to say it again. You know, the Cage Trust, when I was asked if I would do it, because Cage didn't make a plan for this, I said that we can't be an organization that is primarily interested in what John Cage did. We cannot. There's plenty of people in the world that will do that. You know, they're going to take care of that. What I want to do is I want to work with people who are interested in what John Cage is doing now. Isn't that nice? And I really mean it. You know, it's like, you know, what are you doing with Cage? You know, what am I doing with Cage? What is Cage doing? Because the only reason we get to work the way we do with Cage is because of the way he worked.
Yeah.
You know, you can't deconstruct Beethoven's Fifth. I mean, you can, but it becomes a shtick. Cage made works that are mutable, you know, that you can actually take them apart and do them other ways. Right. And that's what we're more interested in. You know, I honestly don't think it's going to take a genius scholar to take the Cage Trust forward.
Well, I think that was exemplary in James Pritchett talking about cheap imitation, and the piece blew my mind. And I am purchasing that album probably twice. But knowing even how Cage adjusted that piece for different instrumentations, and that was the first CD I bought, was Cage playing Cheap Imitation. And I thought that's because he didn't think of himself as a good pianist. So he was a cheap imitation of a pianist. I didn't know the story at all.
It's a really wonderful story.
And I mean, I must have been 20, 21. You know, I just didn't know. And hearing James talk about that piece and you talk about that piece, and I think that is exactly what is John Cage doing today. And I wish everyone said that about all the music they played. Why, you know, why is this relevant today? Yeah. What am I doing with it? And that's, so.
We have to stop.
I know.
We made it through two of your questions.
Two.
It's so pathetic. We're going to be doing this when we're like 100.
But I do have a good time. So, you know, that's what it is.
Thank you so much, Aaron. As ever, it's always such a pleasure to be with you. I'll be calling you to set up the next one, maybe in about, I don't know, a month or so. We don't want people to start taking us for granted.
We'll do more. Thank you so much, Isabel.
Aaron, thank you. Now let's listen to two songs by John Cage, captured at a live performance by students and faculty of the Bard College Conservatory of Music and Music Program at a concert given at the John Cage at Bard College Symposium in 2009. The songs we'll hear, both scored for voice and closed piano, are first, A Flower from 1950, a vocalese performed without vibrato as in folk singing, composed in a double rhythmic structure that follows the structure of the dance for which it was written, choreographed by Louise Lippold,
wife of the American sculptor Richard Lippold. The closed piano lid is knocked upon, either its front or back portions, with the fingers or the knuckles of a closed fist. And second, we'll hear The Wonderful Widow of 18 Springs from 1942, the better known of the two, with words by James Joyce from Finnegan's Wake. The vocal part uses only three pitches, and again, is to be sung without vibrato. Arrows notated in the score, up or down, indicate microtonal pitch changes. I checked, by the way, and Cage composed some 40 works that include the voice, over half of them songs. The Wonderful Widow of 18 Springs, which is one of Cage's most popular, had an outrageously wonderful performance at the close of Cage's centenary by none other than Jesse Norman and Michael Tilson Thomas at the New World Symphony's Cage Symposium called Making the Right Choices. You can see and hear this performance online at www.nws.edu.
Isabel, Madame Isabel.